Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Hackett.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spring from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yeah.
Yes, you are indeed listening to the first edition of Not the Footy Show in 2020. And it's fantastic because it's our 498th show.
What?
And it is also our 15th year on the airwaves.
Bloody hell.
So we've been going a long time, John.
How are you, Ashley?
Good. Happy New Year. I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
And we've, as usual, got a special guest lined up for you today. We're heading into the world of squash. And we're catching up with the Chief Executive Officer of Squash WA, because you may have heard of the one management system that is trying to be forced through by Sport Australia. Well, Squash WA have stood up and they are not going to be a part of it. And they've actually unaffiliated themselves from Squash Australia. Wow. But we'll hear from Dean, who of course was a top player in his day as well.
Excellent. Are you going to start today?
Do you want me to?
Yeah, you go first.
All right, I'll start the new year. And, obviously, John, what I'm looking at, we've just had a tournament, tennis tournament here in Australia.
Uh-huh.
And I was quite surprised, the ATP Cup, to see the Russians participating, because it was on the 9th of December that we heard that WADA had handed, that's the World Anti-Doping Association, had handed down a 4-year ban to the Russian sporting landscape, I suppose you'd call it, from international sporting competition for a doping cover-up that meant the country would not feature in the Tokyo Olympics next this summer coming up, or the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Now, just keep, if I can keep going, yeah, they had a meeting on Monday the 9th of December, voted to exclude Russia and also prevent it from hosting or bidding for any global tournaments, and the ban was imposed by WADA's executive committee after Russia was found to have tampered with laboratory data handed over to WADA as a condition for ending the previous 3-year ban for state-sponsored doping. Now, the ban was criticised by some campaigners for not doing enough. They felt it fell well short. One of those who criticised it was Linda Helleland, who was saying it fell short of the ultimate sanction of a blanket ban for Russia and its athletes. Now, I was confused how the tennis players were playing. Then when I've checked into it, apparently it now falls on all of the international sporting federations as to whether they impose that ban.
Which is staggering, really. Now, I think we've got to make the point here, too. This ban, the athletes aren't banned.
Correct.
It's a ban on competing under the Russian flag. So these athletes can still go to the organisers and say, I want to compete. And they'll go, okay, great. You can't compete as Russia. You have to compete as an individual under the Olympic flag, I believe. So it's not like they're banning athletes as such.
No, so just to also clarify that they had the opportunity to go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport to try and overturn the 4-year ban. Now, they have done that, Russia. They've lodged the complaint. And Thomas Bach, in the last 48 hours since we're recording this, has actually said that he hopes that the ruling from the Court of Arbitration for Sport, Thomas Bach, of course, the IOC president, said he wants it to be watertight so it leaves no room for any other legal challenges that would further delay decisions about how Russian athletes will take part in the Tokyo Olympics 2020, which, again, is going back to what you're saying. Now, what he said is it's important for the IOC and the international federations is that we get a decision which does not leave room for any kind of interpretation. This must be a waterproof decision where everybody concerned knows what to do and what not to do. So what he's saying is we can't afford for sport to be going through the courts for the next 4 years while athletes are trying to get the right to compete at various sporting events.
Interesting. I'm surprised Thomas is across it that much, because he's spending, obviously got a lot, hasn't got much time to spend with all that great work he's doing for hockey. Of course, the winner of the President's Award, wasn't he, at the last FIH Congress, Thomas? What sort of position are WADA? What actual position do they hold when they can say, we're banning these people, but you guys can just do what you want?
But it's ludicrous. Like, so why are all the sporting bodies even involved with WADA? If they're not going to listen and adhere to what they're telling them, then it's pointless WADA really being there.
Well, if you're an athlete and WADA catches you doping,
yeah,
what do you do?
I mean, a lot of them don't worry, do they? They know they'll be out for a couple of years or a year and a half. It'll take 6 months, so they'll be out for that 6 months while they're pending the suspension or the penalty. Then they'll be back in 18 months.
Well, we know what happens. Athletes have told us the best time to get a doping ban is about 2.5 years before the Olympics, because you get the 2 years where you're not being tested, and then you've got your 6 months run up before the Olympics. Off you go.
Yeah, and you get that rest period as well. So you're just training, your body's in peak condition.
Yep. You're juicing up the whole time as well. Don't forget that part.
Allegedly, John.
Allegedly, yes.
Now, the thing that to me is that I think there's several issues here. I think one is there's the lack of clear rules from the sports themselves as to how they would handle drug offenders, let's call it. There is also the failure then to live by their own rules, which they've imposed. And then the punishments aren't strong enough when they find people are guilty. So if you look at athletics, to me, that's what's killed athletics. Everyone says athletics is dead. No one's interested. I think there's a large degree of that. And that is because they have failed to punish adequately those they've found guilty of cheating.
Well, look at the situation with the Chinese swimmer, Sun, is it? And who won an event at a World Swimming Championship, and people fellow athletes refused to acknowledge him on the podium. So they think the bloke's a cheat. All the anecdotal evidence about why he's in trouble with WADA says, you're cheating, mate. You don't walk in there and smash vials if you're not cheating.
But the other thing, John, is when you play any sport, you know, in a dressing room, and even at the top events, if you talk to tennis players, you talk to people, squash players even, or people that are, you know, share a change room before they go out to play a match, you know, and you notice little things about other players. And so usually there are rumours on the circuit, oh, so-and-so, did you know they're doing that? They got a bit of a drink problem. They got a bottle of scotch under the pillow every night. You know, these things are there, and usually there's no smoke without fire because it's a very enclosed little group. Sure, there's a hell of a lot of bitchiness as well, and there will be people trying to diss on and put other people down. But in the main, if there's people proven, you've got to throw them out.
Well, an Australian Olympian once told me that people just don't turn up at the Olympics. They've been competing generally for several years on the international circuit, and before that as juniors. They're not just turning up out of nowhere and suddenly they're an Olympic standard athlete. And you notice about, he was saying that you notice the changes in people. If you meet someone when you're 16 years old the first time you compete against them, by the time they're 24, you look at them and go, that is not right. You're doing something to yourself because that is not your body. And I know people grow on that, but the athletes know because they've been around each other for so long. They know when people are cheating.
I'll give an example. And I mean, I've never taken drugs for performance enhancing reasons, but I can tell you now, and I got questioned
not
about.
Not even the little blue ones, mate?
No, not yet.
Okay.
Anyway, but yeah, when I had chemotherapy, you know, they pumped my body full of drugs then. And I said to the oncologist at the time, he goes, you know, how are you going? Side effects? I said, yeah, usual side effects and all that. But when we kind of were coming out the other side, I said, my body shape has changed. And people are going, nah, don't talk rubbish. I said, no, it definitely has. Like, I know my body and the shape of it changed because of the drugs they gave me. Now, since then, I've met other people who've gone through similar things, and they've said exactly the same thing, that the chemotherapy drugs that they were put upon as well changed their body shape. They noticed changes themselves. Yeah. So if you notice it yourself, people that you're competing against are going to notice it as well. So it does happen, and I know, as I say, from personal experience, that if you pump things that are not meant to be in your body, and it's going to change it.
And look, you know, this isn't an argument just about cheating either. It's a health argument too, because we've seen what happened to many athletes that have been part of these regimented programs, and it's killed them. In the end, it's taken their life because of the drugs they've been forced or tricked or whatever you want to say into taking. And so this is very much a health issue as much as it is about cheating or...
If you read some of the stories about the former East German athletes and, you know, what they've gone through and sex changes, and it is just soul-destroying, you know, how their lives, not destroyed, but have been altered beyond belief.
And kiddies, science is not right because it's science. Okay? There are many, many, many scientists in the world who have no morals, that don't care, that will pump you full of all sorts of shit they can get their hands on if they think they're going to make money out of it and it's going to help their reputations, etc., etc., or there's some, going to be some sort of referred glory on them for it. And it, so they might tell you that what you're saying, oh, it's safe, but in 20 years' time, you know, you'll grow a testicle on your face or something like that. You, no one knows with these drugs. They're very experimental, a lot of them.
Well, there's the famous documentary, and the name of it slips my mind, about the Italian footballers who were all given in, I think it was the 50s or 60s, and they have now all got this brain disease.
Yep.
That is, it's a disproportionate number that were all from the same club to have all ended up with this brain disease. And if I can't remember the name of it, I'm sure if you Google it, if you've never seen it, it is, again, it's very hard-hitting, and it makes you realize, do not put anything in your mouth that you do not know what it
is. And that just doesn't go for the illegal drugs either. I mean, no one really knows what the effects of putting sheep's blood into you is, into your calves, or any sort of stuff like that. All of this experimental stuff, and the athletes are going in saying, yes, do it to me, because we know what athletes are like in the pursuit of glory. They're quite happy to go through it without a lot of due diligence because it's being held up as a panacea for their injury concerns.
Well, I'll throw a question at you now, John. Ooh, okay. I wrote it down in my notes. So WADA have come out saying to the International Sports Federation, ban Russia because of this. They know that they've been cheating and they've tampered with evidence and all of this.
Backed by the IOC.
Exactly. Are the international sporting federations hiding behind WADA? So are they not taking actions themselves and they're going, WADA, you be the bad boy and we're just going to sit back and we'll just see what happens?
Well,
I think they are.
Well, I don't know what they hope to achieve by doing that.
Well, I don't either, but I just wish one or two of them would stand up, stick their head above the turrets and go, okay, we're banning you. You're out. You know, it's like ATP to me, okay, these Russians, but make a stand and just go, sorry. Until we get the Court of Arbitration hearing, is no one is participating.
Well, we've got Russian hockey teams going to be participating in the Euro Hockey Championship very soon. We've got Russian teams competing in the Euro Indoor Hockey that's going on at the moment, or starting next weekend. So it's not like the Russians aren't out there competing as Russians, and we're being told that the leading body...
So what does this ban mean? It means absolutely nothing.
It does. It means nothing.
And it's just confused the average sports fan because they cannot understand how... Hang on, I thought I read that they were banned, which is what I did. And then I find that, oh, no, it's up to the International Federation.
Is that a symbol of the lack of power WADA really has in the sporting universe? Or is it a symbol of the fear of the sports that don't want to really upset the Russians, or, you know, realise perhaps that the Russians ain't the only ones doing it?
I think it's all of the above.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here. You're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Okay, well, welcome back, and as mentioned at the top of the show, we've got a special guest on the show today, and that is a former world number two squash player. He hails from Western Australia. He's now taken on the role as chief executive officer of Squash WA, and it's with great pleasure we welcome Dean Williams to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks, Ashley. Thank you very much for the invite.
Well, I was looking back on your playing career, and some would say you were born in the wrong era, not because of obviously the money back then, but some of the players that you were up against.
You could say that, and it's well documented. I was at the end of the great Jeff Hunt's career, and I was at the beginning of the amazing Jahangir Khan's career. So for 5 years of, in between my 10 years, 5 years with Jeff, and then 5 years of Jahangir. So at the end of that 5 years, I'd had enough of Jahangir, so I retired, and the rest is history. He's basically, and it really saddens me to say that, he is the greatest. Being an Aussie, Jeff Hunt was obviously my idol, and everyone looked up to Jeff, but Jahangir's record is amazing, and they did cross over, and Jeff did beat Jahangir, and Jahangir beat Jeff, so it's an interesting argument for the punters out there who's the greatest of all, but yeah, it was a great era. I had a lot of fun.
Do you feel privileged to have played alongside those two greats of the game?
Absolutely. Never had any aspirations when I started as a young guy travelling around that I would get to that level and be talking to someone like you now, that my career was that crossed over with those two great players. I would never even envisage talking along that line because I wouldn't have put myself in the same category. But playing Jeff in many, many finals around the world, and then Jahangir came on the scene and playing Jahangir in the world finals and about 9 finals actually in the in his career, and a lot of semis and a lot of quarterfinals. I was just so privileged to play against the two of the all-time greats, and I came second a lot, but coming second's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, you were very consistent. You mentioned that because 10 World Opens and you were in 6 quarterfinals in all of those. That's consistent.
Yeah, 6 quarters, 2 semis and 1 final. So I was very proud of my world.
9 years that you were in amongst the last.
I used to love the World Open because the World Open wasn't in a set country. The World Open was played all over the world, obviously, as you would think. Whereas the British Open was always played in the same venue, which I hated. I hated that venue. It was horrible. It was cold. And my best performance was a semi-final in the British Open. And I never really performed as well in the major British Open, which was pretty much the most prestigious tournament, not the wealthiest or the richest. The World Open was. But the World Open was played in Paris, we played it in London, we played it in Australia, we played it in Malaysia, we played it in Germany, we played it everywhere. And it was exciting. It was just different venues. And that's what really, I love that sort of variety.
When you look at the game today, what are your views of it? Because, I mean, the World Tour is now massive, isn't it?
It is.
But there's still not a lot of money there for the players.
It's different. It's different. There is money. There is good money, but it's differently spread. We used to play a lot of what I'd call B-grade tournaments for good money, but not the A-grade tournaments. For example, the Monte Carlo Open or the Swiss Open. And they sound really good, and there was money in them, but they weren't the big tournaments. Now those Swiss Opens and German Opens have disappeared, being replaced by one major tournament in each country. And then the powers that be wanted to have one major tournament in, say, every week or every fortnight or every month, so that the players could actually prepare and you'd have the best players physically ready for every tournament. That didn't happen in our day. We would miss, say, one tournament because we couldn't quite overlap one, and we would jump to the next one, and the other guys would jump to the other one, and then you'd all meet for the World Open.
Yeah.
So I prefer what I went through, playing 40 to 50 tournaments a year, some small, some big. A lot more fun, a lot more travelling, you meet a lot more players, a lot more people, and the players had more fun. Now they're playing two fewer tournaments. So basically, it's different. The prize money for each of the tournaments, by the way, is 10 times what we pay for.
Yeah.
But they haven't got the in-between tournaments. And I'd come home and play the New South Wales Open. Well, it doesn't exist anymore.
That's sad, yeah.
Yeah. So.
No, but I mean, I'm sure it's still tough. I know we've had several players from Squashy in there. They're not in the top sort of 4 or 5, but they're having to pay their own way, sleep at railway stations, and it's tough if you're trying to get on that circuit.
That's what I did. That's what I did in 75 when I went across as a 19-year-old thinking I'd show the Poms how to play squash, and that backfired pretty quick. And I was paying £5 for a rat-infested, flat. No windows, no toilet, no nothing. So we'd go to the squash club, the shower and toilet, and you'd come back to this room. And we would get there at midnight and get the hell out of there at 6 a.m. and start training at the squash club again. So it wasn't glamorous. It wasn't glamorous. But I think you've got to go through that. And there's all sporting stories of all major champions around the world that have actually done the hard yards, slept in their car. Golfers is a good story. They sleep in their car. They're waiting for that big break. Some get it, some don't. You hear about the ones that slept in their car and made the grade.
Yeah.
You don't read about the guys that just disappear. They didn't make it. Squash players, tennis players, same. It's hard yards.
Well, obviously today now you're the CEO of Squash WA. It's a slightly different role, but are you enjoying it?
I am. I'm enjoying it immensely, actually. And I got involved because there were a few issues in WA squash which previous boards and previous presidents had put WA Squash Association into a financial predicament. I wasn't happy about that. I didn't have the time 7 or 8 years ago to really concentrate on trying to put back into the sport and make a difference. I put my hand up a year and a half ago to go on the board to sort these issues out, and then the role of CEO slash general manager came up, and I said I'll change from the board into an operational role because I really have got something to offer and I can make a difference. So that's been a year, and a lot's happened in that year, I can assure you. A lot.
I'm sure. Are you in a better financial state now? So it's.
We are. Yeah. We are. I'm very happy to say that the investment property and the debt that the previous boards and president put our association in has disappeared. We got rid of the debt. We sold off pretty much an unsaleable investment property, which was an office suite. I've managed to do a good deal with the new owner, so WA Squash has now got money in the bank, no debt, and looking forward to 2020, 2021 with some really good ideas and funding that we've managed to procure from the government, which is great.
Now that's great news. Now, I mean, one of the things I know in sport in Australia that's quite a contentious issue at the moment is this one management system that Sport Australia are trying to push. Are they trying to get you to go down that path?
It's a very good question. Squash Australia has officially said no to that, but we have evidence that other states and the National Sporting Organisation, CEO and President before this current President, were definitely moving in that way, but saying they weren't. So we've got a lot of proof in actual fact that they were heading towards what we call a one management policy, and that basically means that the sport would be based, let's say, and they are in Brisbane, and all the states would become a branch, and all the money goes back to the national body, and they don't really need anybody in Perth to run. In this day and age of technology and internet banking, etc., etc., you don't need anybody on the ground in the states as you used to do. So that's their thinking, which is totally wrong, in especially a state like WA, which is huge. We all know geographically it's a massive state. They cannot run squash from Brisbane and expect places like Karratha, Roebourne, Dampier, Carnarvon, Broome, etc. to have any connection at all with Brisbane. So they're saying one thing and doing another. We're challenging that, and we've got proof to the fact, and we've got great support from Minister of Sport Mick Murray, who has written on our behalf to Sport Australia, John Wiley, saying that WA government will support WA squash specifically, and not promoting or not supporting a one management policy. So we will, if need be, break away and go alone.
I get the feeling, having talked to several sports, that that is the feeling in Western Australia, in that everybody feels the same way. It is such a big state, they're covering a massive area, and also there's the problem that the East Coast is so far away, there's time differences that alter during the year, and unless they have those offices open for that extra 2 hours every day, or 3 hours in summer, we're going to get forgotten about.
We are, and you make a very good point, and there are all the reasons why it won't work. And a lot of sports, and you make a good point, many sports are anti it, like us. It does work, though, on the positive side of it, it does work for some sports that are seriously facility-driven. Take, you know, the rowing and the cycling to build velodromes, etc. Your infrastructure is enormously expensive. So to have a one central place in Australia, possibly, to run out of a sport does make sense in some circumstances and some sports, especially Olympic sports. Every 4 years, the funding is enormous. We want to win gold medals, but the actual infrastructure might be hugely expensive. Well, every state in Australia cannot build state-of-the-art velodromes, for example, just because we want one.
Yeah.
And we've got one in Perth, which is pretty dormant, I can tell you. It's not used a lot.
Yeah, I've been out there.
Yeah. So, for those reasons, a unitary model management and for funding and facilities may work, but for sport like squash and many other sports, it does not work.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it and I think, well, there are some sports, as you say, that are sort of fixture-driven, whereas a sport like squash is tournament-driven.
Yep.
I think when it's fixture-driven, you can, as you touched on, the computers can spit out the fixtures and you can sort all of those out from a central office.
Yep.
Whereas I would think if you're having tournament-driven sport, you can't do that because it's very, very different.
No, and you're 100% right. And for all those reasons, I'm very confident that we won't go that way, and we're so anti it from a WA squash point of view that we have actually continued with our threat, and we've continued all of 2019, and we did not pay our membership fee. We are officially unaffiliated and not a member of Squash Australia at the moment. Now, we're working through it. At the last AGM, we managed to oust the previous president, and we now have a president on board, Joanne Brodie from New South Wales, who is a lot more inclusive and a lot more aware of how squash should be run. So we're hopeful. We don't know the future at this stage. I hope we don't go down the path of not being a member of Squash Australia. But if, for example, we don't get value for money for our membership and they still are pushing a one management policy, Mick Murray and even the Premier and DSR in Perth are aware of all this and they are supporting us to break away. So, and we will.
And what's the squash community in sort of Western Australia's reaction? Are they fully behind you as well?
They're fully behind us until, of course, there's some minute detail that does upset a minority of squash players. And unfortunately, it's our juniors and our people representing Australia in masters. So if you're over 35, for example, and over 40 in the different categories, if you were wanting to play for Australia and go to an Australian championship and then continue on to a world championship, as we have got some current world over 55 and over 60 champions currently, being not affiliated, they can't play.
Yeah,
so that's the sledgehammer they take to try and get us back in. Now, is that worth being a member? That's the only benefit. Juniors as well. Now, we've got a lot of good juniors at the moment who might play for Australia under 19. World champs are on in 6 months in Australia. Now, we've been told officially our juniors are not eligible.
That's disgraceful in my book because they're correct. Australians, so therefore they should qualify irrespective.
Correct. But they're using a sledgehammer and they're using big bully tactics to make sure that we roll over and comply and pay our fees, of which we haven't done, as I said. It's controversial. Some parents are getting very upset because their kid may be not eligible. There are ways around that. We've got some kids actually members of other clubs in Australia, but they won't have WA next to their name.
Yeah.
So.
And I mean, have you spoken to the world body, or are they sort of keeping at arm's length with all this going on?
The world body's response was one line back to me, and the world body's response was, appreciate your concerns, we only deal with the national body. Full stop. They will not deal with states or members, they will only deal with the national body.
I mean, these world bodies amaze me sometimes because they all trot out that line, but then when the national body's not doing the right thing, they still don't step in.
They still don't step in, correct.
And yet they'll take the money and they'll take all the kudos.
And they're taking a lot of money out of squash in Australia by Australia being obviously a very powerful member of the WSF, World Squash Federation, and a foundation member. I understand that. And to run world championships and to have a world tour, it's fantastic for the game. But they're taking a lot of money out of squash, which is actually indirectly paid for by members of clubs, because it all filters down. And we have stopped that. We have stopped that money going to our national body at the moment and putting it back into grassroots. Now, that to me is a better way to spend our membership fee. And they're using some pretty heavy-handed tactics. So we're at a very interesting point right now in negotiations.
Well, Dean, it's been wonderful catching up with you, and we're going to have to stay in touch to find out how things progress, but we wish you all the best, and it's going to be very interesting for not only squash but all the other sports in this one management system.
Thank you, Ashley. Loved it. Thanks, mate.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was Dean Williams, the Chief Executive Officer of Squash Western Australia. And John, some really interesting stuff there. I mean, first of all, I just cannot get over when he said he went to the UK in the 70s to try and show the Poms how to play squash. He was living in a rat-infested little bedsit, and he said, you know, you wouldn't even have a shower there, that they were going down to the squash courts to shower in the mornings. But it just lets you know, and he made the point in that, because we hear the stories of those guys who've done the hardships, and then they make it, but there are hundreds of guys that have done that who never made it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, sport and the entertainment industry are very often like that, aren't they? You know, they'll tell you all about the Coal Players and how they made it, but not the 500,000 bands that have never made a cent out of it.
Like John Lee and the Hookers.
Yeah, we're not likely to be making much money in the future, mate.
But I think the other thing, then, the crucial thing in that interview is this whole one management system for sport in Australia that is being pushed by Sport Australia. I take my hat off to the board of Squash WA, to the CEO, and to all of the people in the squash community here in Western Australia for standing up and saying, no. We're giving you, as Dean said, they're giving $16,000 a year to be a member of the national body. They're getting nothing back. Now, the concerning thing, and we've seen this in so many sports where they use this cudgel and go, well, if you're not part of it, we're not going to pick your juniors. And as he said in the interview, we're not going to pick your vets. So those individuals, just going back to like the wildest argument, the individuals are being punished, but it's misadministration that is actually causing people to take this stand. And then you're trying to punish individuals so that those individuals will get a groundswell of support and force the wrong decision by the administration. What is going on in the world of sport? It's all gone upside down.
You know what? Who used to be the best administrators in sport? Going back 40 years, who were the best administrators? And what were they known for? What were the traits that made them such good administrators? Because the way sport's administrated now is really worrying, moving forward into the new era of professional sport in this century, because it will change, and it will change dramatically, and that'll be led by things like e-sport. It won't be, you know, basketball has to watch out for hockey, or hockey has to watch out for soccer or something like that. It'll be these new sports that are going to take over. It won't be the old sports that do.
Oh, look, I had to voice over the e-sports at the Southeast Asian Games, and I must admit I was talking about things I did not have a clue about.
Some hollies in there?
Well, no, there was Lava Burst, which apparently is featuring a certain game. I impressed someone recently when I threw that into a conversation. They go, oh, they were playing this game. I was like, yeah, you could be right. Okay. but going back to it, I think the old thing was, this is my call, is I think in the olden days, the boards weren't as involved in the day-to-day running. I think there's been a horrible crossover now where people on the board interfere too much in the day-to-day running of sports. And that's not just at the international level, that's at national level and at state level here in Australia. On top of that, I also think we've got very weak management, in that you've got career management rather than actual leaders who are leading these sports. And that, again, is a real problem. And one of the big things we've talked on before, and we had a guest, I can't remember which podcast, talking about the marketing of sport, is a lot of these second-tier sports, the people they are employing in order to market their sport are second-tier people, because the best ones are already at the top sports. They're doing a fantastic job. And let's be honest, AFL, the sport we don't mention on this show, does a great job of marketing its sport.
Oh, brilliant.
Cricket Australia, fantastic the way they've come back from the sandpaper incident and have managed to get themselves back in the public conscience.
Basketball.
Everyone back on board. Exactly. There's some sports that do it really, really well, and they've got the best people. Now, if you can't get the best people, you've got to find another way of doing it. So again, that to me comes from strong leadership, where they go, you know what, we're not going to employ someone in marketing, we're going to contract somebody in marketing. That's strong leadership as well. Noticing where you're weak and finding a way that you can fill that gap by actually going down another path, not the traditional path. I was talking to someone again from one sport, I'm not going to say which sport, And I've known this sport for a long time. And I said, we were having a conversation over Christmas. I said, the biggest problem is the structure of that organization is exactly the same as it was 25 years ago. Now, to me, if you're in a sporting organization and the structure is the same as it was 25 years ago, you're behind the eight ball because sport has evolved and you should not have the same structures you had 20 years ago.
And I think, too, administrators should be put on the same pay scale as the players and the athletes.
I think they should be performance-based. Yeah, absolutely.
There's no reason why administrators should get six-figure pays and superannuation paid while the athletes themselves are subsisting on sub-minimum wage and will have, you can have a 15-year international career and end up with nothing at the end of it. That's a complete joke. If you're an administrator for 15 years, you've probably got a very healthy nest egg by the end of that time.
But the other problem you have there, John, is we've got administrators that are cheating the participation figures, and some of them have their bonuses based on those participation figures. So, again, if you're going to be a board, you've got to get your checks and balances in place so that you're not giving people money when they're fiddling the books to get those bonuses.
Well, I would consider that the captain of your national team should be on at least the same amount of money as your CEO.
Fair call. I'm going to get an argument from me.
Okay. Let's get on to my topic now. It's two topics within the one sport, actually, because we've just recently had the conclusion of the test series for the summer here in Perth, in Australia, both against Pakistan and then, secondly, New Zealand. Fairly underwhelming test series, it must be said, both of them.
I was really disappointed in New Zealand. I thought they were going to be better than that.
I was really disappointed in Pakistan, too. I don't think they showed much at all. I don't know what they were thinking when they came here because from the very beginning, it looks like their selections were a bit suspect.
I think their focus, though, seems to be much more on the shorter game these days.
Yeah, it does. But a couple of things came out of the recent tests here in Australia and in South Africa between England and South Africa. Firstly, the four-day test. The call has started, Ashley. The four-day test. Brilliant. What do you think? Let me guess. You hate it. You hate the idea of a four-day test.
I absolutely do.
Look, let's face it. Cricket hasn't been 5 days forever. I can remember when I first started watching the game, test matches went for 6 days. One of them was a rest day. So on Sunday, they'd all toddle off to the golf course and have a round.
In the UK, it was Sundays,
Yeah, it was Sundays. And we've seen, over history, we've seen various incarnations of what a test match is. I think they've had three-day tests at one stage, unlimited open tests at other times.
Yep. Timeless tests.
Timeless tests, yeah, that's it. So are we being a bit precious about holding on to the five-day test?
Well,
I don't think we are. I think 5 days is perfect for test cricket.
Well, I'll take you back to a conversation we had ages ago that was raised by the great cricket writer Neville Cardis, who he felt that what should be... it was Ian Peebles, not Neville Cardis, who he believed that new coming test teams, so like, for example, we've got, Ireland are in, Afghanistan are in now playing test cricket. He said they probably don't have the depth to go 5 days. And this was back in the 50s that he was saying this, that they should be playing four-day tests. I actually was in favour of that. You shot me down on that ages ago. But I don't think the traditional and the established countries should ever stray away from the five-day test. But I do think maybe so that those can acclimatise. But then there is the argument that I think you put forward at the time is when are they going to learn to bat for 3 days if they don't get the chance to bat for 3 days? But to me, the reason we're going down this, and we know it's a commercial reason, that's the only thing, because you've had the captain of Australia, the captain of England, the captain of South Africa, all the captains of the recent test matches have all spoken out about it. And so you know that this has nothing, it's going to free up 40 days for the world of cricket to organise other fixtures. Now, just to give you an idea, so from September 2018 to September 2019, there were 183 international T20 matches. There were 170 ODIs and 44 test matches.
Yeah, okay.
Now, let's not remember, T20 was never meant to be taken seriously. It was always meant to be a bit of a laugh. And when it first came on the scene, we were told it would never have international status. Now, yep. I just find it terrifying that though the cricket world have allowed India, Australia and England to have control of the ICC, that they have the sway of votes, and that these three countries, and let's not forget that they are now planning a tri-series between themselves, and it's all about those guys getting a bigger slice of the pie, and I just hope the cricket world just boycotts it and just goes, no, 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 we're not having any part of this.
You know what it'll do? That'll be the end of that'll be the end of cricket. It will become the end of cricket, because all these other nations that are currently on the periphery will have nowhere to go. There'll be nothing for them to play for if that's the way that it pans out.
But I mean, you touched on that. Sure, not all the test matches go 4 days. But when some of them do, they can be the most exciting games ever.
That's it. And, you know, people go, oh, well, so many games are only ending in 4 days. Which, you know what's going to happen if they cut that day off? Watch how many games start ending in 3 days.
But you're going to end up with draws because people are just going to bat for a day and whatever and hang around. And I just think you're going to lose that battle of mental fitness, mental strength. Well, just I think we're already losing players that can bat long innings.
Just think about New Zealand in the recent test series. I mean, every test they were in on the fourth day, looking ahead going, oh, my God, we've got the best part of 2 days to bat out here. Whereas if it had been a 4 day test, they would have gone, oh, we've only got to get 375 overs. And that becomes achievable.
But to me, the thing that they need to be looking at, and I've said this for a long time, is A, I think the standard of bowling worldwide has dropped dramatically. There are some phenomenal bowlers now. I think Pat Cummins, probably the best in the world, is outstanding. But the rest of the bowlers are pretty, some of them are not that good. I mean, again, and what I'm judging that on is the amount of bowlers that can travel around the world and take wickets. They're all home trackers. But also the tracks that are being prepared around the world are batting tracks. So who wants to be a bowler these days? So to me, the ICC needs to be looking at that and preparing wickets that are test match wickets.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they've got to also put the boundaries back out in T20 games.
100% agree. Boundaries need to go back out. None of this catching the ball and jumping back. If the ball's gone over the line, I always thought it was a straight line up in the air. So if you go over the boundary with it and you're in the air, that's a six.
See, I don't really have much of a problem with that. I just have a problem with the fact that I'm sick of hearing commentators go, oh, that's a massive hit, and the ball drops between the boundary, the traditional boundary, and the rope in the infield.
But do you remember when
hang on a sec, that's not that big at all. That would have been out in a normal cricket game.
Exactly. So just quickly on Pat Cummins, I just want to say something. This is going slightly off track. You probably haven't seen it. There's an advert on Fox promoting the Foxtel app, which for those of you who are listening overseas, Foxtel is like our pay TV. And he's sitting in the change room and the wicket's falling and it goes, you know, he's waiting to go in and he's got his pads on. Then he gets up his iPad and he starts flicking through all the sport. And then he's getting up doing impressions of A-League footballers, of basketballers celebrating. By the end, he's taken all his pads and kit off, and then Mitchell Starc comes in and goes, hey, Pat, you're in. Now, to me, for a player who is as good as he is, who is obviously going to be idolised by the next generation of fast bowlers, what kind of advert is that? That you're not watching the game, you're on your iPad watching other sport during a supposed test match because he's got his baggy green when you're next in. I mean, who the hell's his manager and thought that was a good idea?
No, but it's whatever his manager is doing, keep doing it though, because Pat's doing all right at the moment.
But also, he's not a bad bat, so I'm amazed that he would want to do an ad like that anyway.
It's interesting that they're talking about him as potential captain, and it's not often bowlers get talked about seriously in that role. And so,
who would be the last bowler of Australia to captain them?
Captain,
you'd be going back away.
I can't think of one off the top of my head. Not in my lifetime.
Richie Benner.
Yeah, probably. He would be. Can you think of another bowler?
Not in my lifetime, I can't.
Warnie never bowled, captained a one-off. Nah.
Gilchrist did a few, but he was a wicketkeeper. Ponting and Border both bowled a little bit, Clark bowled a little bit. Yeah, they were batsmen.
You go back before then. You got
Mark
Bill
Taylor,
You know, Kim Hughes.
Benno would be your last one.
Yeah. And I look around other countries. I mean, they stand out. Imran Khan stands out. Wakar and the other fella, the big fella. Pakistani. Wakar and the other fella.
Wazim Akram. The late Bob Willis.
Courtney Walsh. Didn't he captain West Indies?
He did. But Bob Willis did as
Bob
well.
Willis. But they're outliers. They're not.
Yeah.
Sean Pollock.
All rounder, yeah.
All rounder. So, yeah. Now, while we're on bowlers, no balls. What? Now, we've been on this bandwagon. We have been on this bandwagon. What the hell is happening? What are umpires doing? What are administrators doing? Poor players. I mean, you as a bowler would know that you need the feedback from the umpire. And especially now in the world where they, of the, you know, the instant video replay where they're being pinged by, you know, little tiny fractions of a fraction.
But yeah, why umpires today cannot do what the umpires for 100 years managed to do, which is keep an eye on the front foot and still on the trajectory of the ball and give an LBW and usually be right.
Well,
I find it incredible.
I just think they've got to take it all away from them now. It's got to the point where either we're getting rid of this technology and you're just going to have to make the call. And if you don't make the call, you will be the subject of derision from the sideline.
I would like that option personally.
It'll be replayed over and over. Or after every delivery, there's an umpire who just looks at it. See, now the thing about a no ball is that batsmen don't pick up the front foot no ball. It's not like the old days when it was a back foot rule. So it's not affecting what the batsman does whatsoever. So after every delivery, that one was a no ball. Oh, for the last ball he bowled was a no ball. Okay, no worries. I'll inform people.
Well, I think in India they
just add the ball onto the end of the over.
But in India, I think they're trialling a third umpire out on the pitch to look for that.
Well,
and he's going to get in the way of the fielders.
He doesn't need to be on the bloody pitch. You can. They've all got cameras set up there. It would be very. In fact, in most cases, if he's just watching that shot and that fourth or third umpire, if they're just watching that single shot of the crease line, they'll pick up most of them at the time. They won't need the video replay. They'll bloody well see them.
Well, the other thing I would throw in there, John, is, you know, years ago there was no such thing as a bowling coach. There is now, so someone's getting paid a wage to make sure these guys don't bowl no balls, that they get their run-ups right.
Well,
so these are the guys who should be getting their backsides kicked.
Well,
I mean, can you believe I was told this by someone? He said some of the players now, they don't even measure out their own run-up, that the bowling coach goes out and measures it before the start of play. I was like, you're having a laugh. How the heck can a bowler do that? That is ludicrous. But then, listen to this. I don't know if you heard, well, no, Fox on the cricket, when the no ball happened, I think it was, who was it, the Australian bowler that Phillips hooked? I've forgotten his name now.
Yeah,
anyway, yeah, and it was given a Pattinson.
Yeah.
And it was given as a no ball. This former Australian bowler, who I must admit I never particularly rated, he was very good at getting the tail enders out, not the top order. He said he used to base his run up on where the umpire stood. That was where he started his jump. He then continues to say, so I was really buggered when the umpire moved. And you think, what kind of moron are you? And this is a guy now doing commentary. I couldn't believe it, John. That, to me, said it all.
Oh, well, it's interesting you mentioned about coaching there, because I heard someone on the cricket commentary recently talking about their time under the tutelage of Jason Gillespie in England. And this person was saying Gillespie stands there at the net and bags them when they overstep. And
good on him.
And just gives them hell for overstepping. No, into them. And that's what they need. That's what bowlers need. And because they can, you know, when you're overstepping, when you're and in the nets overstepping, you know, you're half a yard in front. But because of the microscopic measurements involved now and the degree these guys are trying to get the most advantage of going all the time, they need that guidance from the umpire to know where they're going.
And, to me, there is no excuse.
The other side, it's a run. A no ball is a run to the batting team. So every time you don't call a no ball, you're cheating the batting team out of a run and out of an extra delivery.
Well, Broad in the South African test had the same thing happen. A dismissal was overturned. But then Sean Pollock in commentary said, I think he'd bowled five in the previous 12 balls.
Yeah.
So there was six runs that the umpire on the pitch missed.
And another, which means another six balls that would have had the opportunity to score from as well.
And the bowler gets tired bowling an extra over.
Yeah. They've got to do something about it, and it's either go whole hog one way or wind it all back the other and just not.
You know my view, I think this whole video thing, let's get rid of it out of all these sports.
That ball tracking technology is rubbish. I'm sorry, I don't mind so much snickos and things, but ball tracking, it's got knobs on it.
I've been saying that for a long, long time.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is now.
See ya. We'll be back next week.